You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Monday, April 30th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, from Salon.com, Glenn Greenwald on how to get rich with no money down. All you need to do is destroy evidence of torture and then get a book deal. Do you have to worry about perhaps leaking classified information about torture? And today is April 30th. That means tomorrow, if I have my dates correct, is May 1st. May Day. MG. What is it?
M1GS.
M1GS. There's going to be actions in at least 125 cities across this country. Probably hundreds more across the globe. We will have Jeff Smith on today to give us a little update. Tomorrow, we'll be out in Bryant Park as the Guitarmy is starting their practice sessions. There's going to be actions all throughout New York City. And perhaps in the city or towns you live in, take the day off. We're going to be casual, at least. We're not going to take the day fully off, but we're going to be casual about it. Also on the program today, student debt, over $1 trillion. What will be cut if the Republicans have their way in avoiding the doubling of the interest rate for government-sponsored student loans? Austerity still failing, still seeming to make no impression on our policymakers and our elite commentators and the financial fraud unit. Well, let's we got a minute. We'll talk about this. We've been mentioning for the past couple of days, past week or two, that the financial fraud unit, this is the task force set up where Eric Schneiderman is sitting atop it, coming in the wake of the mortgage settlement, which basically let the bankers off with a tremendous amount of fraud. And we've since seen a spike in foreclosures since then, because now the banks realize, oh, we've got to get out of jail free card. We don't have to worry about it. Reuters now reporting that the financial fraud task force is planning to add five financial analysts and 10 new assistant federal prosecutors spread across the country. This is according to the Department of Justice, obviously responding from the rash of stories saying they don't even have an office or a phone number yet. This is I think they put these ads in the paper looking for these people. They're looking for someone to go in and litigate, according to this Reuters document. To me, it just reads like a joke, frankly. And clearly a response to the criticism that is out there that nothing's being done in terms of this financial fraud task force. Take it for what it will. In addition to the 50 positions the department previously announced, the DOJ is hiring 10 new assistant U.S. attorneys. in districts that include Massachusetts and Colorado, according to job listings on the agency's website. Is this really real? At one point, I think they ask if somebody wants to represent the United States in court. Another sign the department is looking to pursue these cases through courtroom litigation. It is said it is looking for someone, quote, who can handle matters in court persuasively on behalf of the United States. Seriously? You don't want to put an experienced litigator on this? Maybe let's see what we can get on Craigslist. We get somebody on there. Presumably, you need to have a law degree, or maybe I'd try and sign up, sort of supplement the income of this program. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Glenn Greenwald. I don't know. We should ask him. Maybe he's looking for a job. I wonder what the application process is. All right, we got to take a break. We'll be right back with Glenn Greenwald after this. I turn my camera on, I cut my fingers on the way of slipping away. I turn my feelings on, you made me untouchable for life. Yeah, yeah, and you wasn't alone. It hit me like a ton. You hit me like a ton. All right, we are back on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Glenn Greenwald. Of course, he is a writer at Salon.com, author of several best-selling New York Times bestsellers, his latest with Liberty and Justice for Some. Welcome to the program, Glenn.
Great to be back, Sam.
I think the favorite part of this story, and I want to talk, obviously, about the recent book that's come out, capitalizing on the destruction of evidence by Jose Rodriguez. And I also want to talk about Philip Zekalow's memo that came out a couple of weeks ago that got, seemed to get very little attention. But in the story about the book Hard Measures by Jose Rodriguez, you talked about perhaps including this story in your book, but you just thought there's just no chance this guy's going to get away with it. Back it up and tell us a little bit about this.
Well, basically, Jose Rodriguez came to public attention in 2007 when the New York Times revealed that at the time they thought two videotapes that were in the CIA's possession that showed interrogations of Al-Qaeda suspects had been destroyed on the orders of Jose Rodriguez, who was the director of essentially the covert unit of the CIA. It turned out that actually 92 videotapes that were in the CIA's possession had been destroyed on his orders, and they showed interrogations. They videoed interrogations of a variety of Al-Qaeda suspects, including many who we now know were waterboarded and subjected to other forms of torture. And what made that revelation so significant was that at the time that he ordered those videotapes destroyed, there were multiple court orders that had instructed the CIA to preserve any and all evidence relating to CIA interrogation. Some of these courts were investigating the causes of 9/11. Others were investigating claims that the CIA had tortured people. And so any videotapes that existed of interrogations were highly relevant to these judicial proceedings. And so multiple federal courts had ordered that the CIA preserve these videotapes and produce them, turn them over. And the 9/11 Commission did the same. The 9/11 Commission investigated what happened with 9/11. Obviously, one of the very first pieces of evidence they were interested in was any interrogations of people who had knowledge of 9/11. And they also ordered, using their binding subpoena power, the CIA to preserve and disclose any videotape showing interrogations of Al-Qaeda suspects or people with knowledge of 9/11. And so by ordering these videotapes destroyed, Jose Rodriguez violated numerous court orders, and as even the chairman of the 9/11 Commission put it, obstructed the investigation of the 9/11 Commission. And that act of violating court orders and obstructing formal judicial and other forms of government investigations are very serious felonies. It's obstruction of justice. It's contempt of court, for which many, many people are in prison. And the Obama Justice Department, actually the Bush Justice Department, appointed a special prosecutor to determine whether crimes had been committed. And then under the Obama Justice Department, that investigation was closed, and the announcement was made that there would be no charges brought against Jose Rodriguez, which is why he's now free to write this book and tour the country and make a lot of money defending not only the torture policies that the CIA used, but also his decision to destroy this evidence.
I mean, this is really stunning. And I mentioned that you had mentioned in one of the pieces you've written that you contemplated putting it in your book about how there is sort of an elite picking and choosing as to who is going to pay for their crimes. And you thought, chances are this guy is going to have to face some type of penalty. And he got none.
Right. Actually, what happened was I was talking to my editor when I was writing the book. And the argument of my book, as you just said, was that political elites, when they get caught committing crimes, don't end up being indicted or held criminally accountable. And I actually thought, when I was writing the book, that this was going to be a case that undercut that thesis, that because of how glaring the crimes were in this case, and because people like Tom Kane and Lee Hamilton, the chairman of the 9/11 Commission, were angry about what had happened because other elites were angry, that this would actually be a case where Jose Rodriguez would get indicted, and I would have to basically treat this as an exception to the thesis that I was arguing. I was sure that it was going to undercut the book. And yet, as before I finished the book, the Justice Department announced that, in fact, Jose Rodriguez would not be charged with any crimes in connection with the destruction of these videos, nor would anybody else involved in the destruction of this evidence. And so I actually put a little passage in the book saying, even in this case, where even I, one of the most cynical people on the planet when it comes to these things, thought that he would be indicted because it was just too glaring even for our totally corrupt political culture not to indict him. Even in the case this extreme and obvious, they end up shielding people who commit crimes as part of the government.
To your knowledge, has any of the people involved in this investigation, have any of those people who publicly decried the fact that the CIA had destroyed these tapes, and have they come out and said anything about the lack of prosecution in this instance?
I don't really know anybody who actually has objected to the fact that Jose Rodriguez or anybody else involved in the destruction of these videotapes has been shielded from prosecution. And one interesting thing, the New York Times, when they reported on it in the first couple months, actually said that there were people in the White House, the highest levels, who had been consulted about the destruction of these videotapes, and some were even encouraging that they be destroyed. And Jose Rodriguez himself says the reason he finally ordered the videotapes to be destroyed is because he couldn't get an answer one way or the other from the White House definitively about whether they should be destroyed. And he took that to mean that they basically wanted him to destroy these videotapes but didn't want to have their fingerprints on it and let him go and do it. So an investigation would have explored necessarily that question as well. He would have undoubtedly claimed that he had encouragement from the highest levels of the Bush Department, the Bush White House, and the Justice Department to destroy the videotapes. And so it would have potentially incriminated a whole slew of other officials, and that's the reason I think the Justice Department stayed away. Just one interesting note on this. Jose Rodriguez was interviewed last night on 60 Minutes about his book. And 60 Minutes, of course, is owned by the CBS Corporation, which also owns Simon & Schuster, which is the publishing company that is publishing Jose Rodriguez's book. So CBS is profiting off this defense of torture and other crimes.
I'm sure that's a coincidence.
Total coincidence, obviously. I don't mean at all to suggest any causal connection there. And Dianne Feinstein, who, of course, is the Democratic chairwoman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, issued a statement responding to Jose Rodriguez's interview. And she said, she's angry about the defense of torture. But she also said, quote, his decision to order the destruction of the tapes was in violation of instructions from CIA and White House lawyers and illustrates a blatant disregard for the law. So, Washington elites constantly say that here is an example of flagrant criminality, and yet the idea that it should be that he should have been indicted for what Dianne Feinstein calls a blatant disregard for the law is something that never gets mentioned.
Do you buy that? Do you buy that he only got a non-answer from the White House? In other words, what's to prevent him from saying that when, in fact, he got some winks and some nudges and said, you know, we're going to make sure things internally that you're protected this way. You make sure that we're protected externally, and we'll call it a day.
Well, that's what's so interesting is the New York Times in its early reporting actually said that they had sources which had very clearly told them that senior White House officials had approved of the destruction of the videotapes. And, you know, the history of the Bush administration has been that they commit acts that are against the law and are very adept at doing it in a way that gives them legal cover. And so that's typically how things have happened is, you know, the idea that some mid-level official like Jose Rodriguez or upper to mid-level official like Jose Rodriguez would have on his own simply ordered these videotapes destroyed unless he had the approval, implicit or otherwise, as you say, of top administration officials. You know, it's really strange credulity. I mean, this is a lifelong bureaucrat. And the CIA, and he actually talked about this in his book and in his interview, you know, the CIA, with everything they were doing in the war on terror, was obsessed with making sure that they weren't hung out to dry. So when they, you know, were going to go torture people, that was why they were so insistent that before they did that, they got very detailed approvals from the Justice Department, because they knew that if at some point torture became controversial and they didn't have all these documents approving of it, that they would be essentially the scapegoats. And people would say, oh, look, the CIA broke the law, and we, the political officials, would never have approved of this and didn't even know about it. And so that was very much their mentality. They didn't do anything controversial without getting clear approval from the political branches. And so I absolutely believe Jose Rodriguez when he says that he was getting clear indications that this was something that he should have done.
To a certain extent, I mean, this is just a replay of Ollie North in some respects, right? We have a rogue guy who has gone out on his own. Nobody seems to remember telling him what to do. And there's really no way to hold him accountable.
Right. I mean, this is John Poindexter famously called that plausible deniability, making sure that when you instruct mid-level officials who follow orders to break the law, that you give them the approval that they need in their own minds, but make certain that you're not actually formally tied to it. This is the game that Washington has been playing for a long time in order to break the law with impunity. You know, and I think what would have happened had Jose Rodriguez been indicted, the first thing that he would have done would have been to say, I was told to do this by Justice Department officials and White House officials. And it would have sucked in the entire political apparatus of the executive branch and incriminated them in very serious ways. And the Obama Justice Department has proven over and over and over that the one thing it wants to avoid desperately is any criminal investigation that implicates high-ranking political officials. And that seems to be the reason they stayed as far away from possible from indicting Jose Rodriguez.
And you know, this is also, we saw earlier this month, I just want to turn to this, we saw earlier this month a memo, I guess it was, documents showing that the State Department counselor, Philip Zelikow, who was very closely associated with Condoleezza Rice at that time, and I think even prior, he had also argued that torture was a problem. There's been virtually no coverage, no implications to any of these documents.
Well, one of the most important political consensus to have formed in the past 3 or 4 years, and by political consensus, I mean the opinion of pretty much all members of the establishment media, with almost no exceptions, as well as the leadership of both political parties, has been that there should be no investigations, criminal investigations, of Bush-era crimes, including torture. And the argument that has been made, the principal argument that was made to justify that belief, is that the people who did the torturing, namely the high-level political officials who authorized it, like Condoleezza Rice and John Ashcroft and Colin Powell and George Bush and Dick Cheney, had believed in good faith that what they were ordering was legal because they were told it was legal by the Justice Department. And that similarly, the people who did the torturing, the physical doing of the torturing, the CIA agents, were also told by the Justice Department that it was legal and were instructed to do it by their political superiors. Now, the reason why that has never been a persuasive argument is because the reality of what happened is that they knew that it was illegal and simply wanted those Justice Department memos in order to cover up, in order to provide them with the permission slip, in order to do it. It wasn't like they set out to get a, in good faith, a legal understanding of what the limits were on what they could do, got it, and then complied. No, they knew they wanted to torture and knew they needed Justice Department memos in order to do it. And as long as they got a stamp of approval from the Justice Department for things that everyone knew was illegal, they felt like they would be protected. And what, you know, these in isolated instances where people within the administration are saying, look, these things that you're authorizing are actually illegal. And one of the ways that we know that it's illegal is that we ourselves, the U.S. government, have always said it's illegal when other people have done it. We've prosecuted other countries for doing it. We've prosecuted the leaders for doing it. The international tribunals have prosecuted people for doing it. The reason why that's so damning to this Washington consensus is because it shows that even people in the government knew that what they were doing was illegal. They didn't think they were doing something legal, and it just proved in good faith that they were wrong. They knew full well that it was illegal, and the Zellico memo, like others, where people in the government were saying what you're doing is illegal, really give the lie to that central claim from the Democratic and Republican parties and the Washington media that prosecutions are unwarranted because they believed in good faith that the, what they were doing was legal and had no idea that it was against the law.
Now, there were reports, I think maybe it was also late in September of 2011, of a talk that a member of the transition team gave, Berkeley Law School Dean Christopher Edley Jr., who basically said at this forum, and I guess he followed up supposedly via email to a reporter, Andrew Krieg at the justiceintegrity.org, that the one of the reasons why the Obama administration just didn't pursue it was not just because of this notion of politically speaking, people wanted to turn the page and whatnot, but there was a genuine fear that there would be some type of scary pushback from the CIA, from I guess other elements of our, you know, defense or as you will, apparatus.
Right. Well, you know, I have no idea whether that's true or not. You know, you can look at it in two different ways. You can look at it as a kind of retroactive excuse for why there weren't prosecutions. Well, there would have been this, I think he called it a coup from within the intelligence and defense, you know, worlds. You could alternatively look at it and say, you know, that's a reasonable fear. Remember, 60 years ago, Dwight Eisenhower warned that, you know, the military-industrial complex was getting more powerful than even democratically elected officials. That was, you know, 5 decades ago, and it's gotten vastly worse on pretty much every level since then. And so the idea that, you know, the CIA and the permanent, you know, military class in Washington has serious weapons that they can use against even political officials who are, you know, at the highest rung of the ladder, like the president, is totally reasonable and probably true. But, you know, if you run for president of the United States and you take the oath where you put your hand on, you know, the Bible and swear that you will protect and defend the Constitution, you have the obligation, because the Constitution compels you to faithfully execute the law, to fulfill that oath. And if you're too afraid of what the CIA is going to do to you or what the Defense Department is going to do to you, then no, anybody who thinks that way has no business being president. And so, you know, I have no idea whether that was a legitimate, you know, whether they truly had that fear or not. But what I do know is that if they decided to accommodate that fear, which meant shielding some of the country's most egregious criminals, remember, torture has long been held to be one of the most egregious crimes anyone can commit, from criminal accountability, then that's to their eternal shame and disgrace. That reflects very, very poorly on their character and their ability to lead.
Is there any opportunity for a guy just, I mean, starting with just the sort of the most obvious target, at least right now, a guy like Jose Rodriguez, to be charged, investigated down the road? I mean, is there some type of statute of limitations, or is it he's just this confident because he just sees that there's just no way this DOJ is going to do anything about it, regardless of who is president in this election, that their DOJ is not going to do anything about it. There's nothing that state AGs or district attorneys can do. This guy must feel pretty confident that there's no point in him not making money off of this at this point.
Right. I mean, can you blame him? I mean, you know, in the past 4 years, there has not been a single Bush official criminally investigated for any of the rampant. I mean, they got caught eavesdropping on the American public in violation of one of the clearest laws you could possibly ever find, which was FISA, that said it is a criminal offense punishable by up to 10 years in prison, five years in prison, and a $10,000 fine to eavesdrop on the communications of the American any American citizen without getting a warrant from the FISA court. They got caught red-handed doing that. Not a single investigation other than the person who blew the whistle on the program, right? Thomas Tam. He was the only one who was investigated. You have a torture regime where George Bush and Dick Cheney go around the country writing books and making tons of money, proudly defending and boasting about the fact that they authorized torture. Not a single investigation from any of that. Alberto Gonzalez repeatedly lied to Congress and in so many other ways, which is also a felony for which people have gone to prison. No investigations. And then you have the Obama Justice Department saying that they are closing the books on the Jose Rodriguez inquiry. And so if even the Obama administration isn't going to investigate Jose Rodriguez, why would you have any fear if you're him that you'll ever be investigated? Yes, there is a statute of limitations. But even more comfortingly, if you're him, our political class and our establishment media have proven beyond a doubt that one of their highest religious beliefs is that there should be no criminal investigations for any of these matters. And so, you know, if I were him, that's the last thing I'd be worried about.
Yet there's every reason to believe that if there was someone in Jose Rodriguez's office who had been a witness to this destruction of these tapes and had gone to the New York Times or gone to had gone to Glenn Greenwald and become a source for such story, there's every reason to believe that person would be facing criminal charges right now.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, I think that of all the things that the Obama administration has done, this is probably one of the worst, which is the Orwellian mantra that was invoked, the slogan to justify shielding Bush officials from any criminal accountability has been look forward, not backward. We need to look forward as a nation, not backward. And yet at the very same time, the very same administration who peddled that phrase repeatedly has waged this vicious and truly unprecedented war on whistleblowers, including people who have exposed government corruption 8, 9, 10 years ago, people whom the Bush administration decided even that they weren't going to indict. The Obama administration has become obsessed with prosecuting people who expose government corruption and wrongdoing. So it isn't just that they've shielded high-level officials who commit crimes. It's that they, at the same time, are vehemently prosecuting the people who expose those very same crimes. I mean, they tried to put Thomas Drake, rather, the NSA official who exposed illegal government eavesdropping. They tried to put him in prison for decades, if not life, by prosecuting him under very dubious espionage charges that fell apart. And you're absolutely right. If you commit torture and other high-level crimes, you can be certain you'll be protected by the Obama administration. But if you expose those crimes, you can be certain that you're going to be prosecuted.
Do you think I find myself not even starting with this base point, but there was a time, and it wasn't that long ago, where we really perceived the Department of Justice as its independence from the rest of the administration being crucial to its capacity to do a job. This was going back during the Nixon era. When I went to law school, they had farmed out from Harvard the retired professors, and Archibald Cox was teaching there. And he, of course, was a Department of Justice official, refused to go along with the president's cover-up. There was a notion that the head of the DOJ was supposed to be independent from the rest of the administration. Am I mistaken, or does it seem like that's not even a factor in the way that these things are discussed? I mean, if President Obama is basically saying we need to turn the page, is it the implication there that he's instructed the Department of Justice to turn the page and that the Department of Justice has no independence? Or is it simply we just now take that for granted?
Yeah, this was a point that really got obscured during that entire debate over whether there should be investigations. It wasn't just that President Obama was telling the Justice Department that he thought they should look forward, not backwards, that there should be no investigations. Rahm Emanuel went on ABC News and decreed that there should be no Justice Department investigations, that the president believes they should look forward, not backward. The next day and for the next week, Robert Gibbs continuously emphasized that that should be true. Jane Mayer and Charlie Savage both reported that Emanuel and other White House officials were pummeling Eric Holder behind the scenes over the fact that he hadn't yet foreclosed the possibility of all investigations. It was continuous White House interference in the decisions by the Justice Department about whether or not to prosecute people. This has always been one of the most extreme and incontrovertible signs of corruption, the interference on the part of the White House, political interference with decisions of who should and should not be prosecuted. Remember, the entire scandal of Alberto Gonzalez and Karl Rove was that they were trying to pressure the Justice Department to prosecute certain people who were Democrats and to shield other people who were Republicans from prosecution. They were interfering, and they fired the U.S. attorneys who refused to carry out their orders. That was the big scandal, that what they were doing was compromising the integrity and the independence of the Justice Department. As you say, that was Richard Nixon's big scandal. The Saturday Night Massacre was he tried to direct the Attorney General to interfere in the investigations of the special prosecutor. And rather than do so, the Attorney General resigned because it was such an offensive idea that the White House could interfere with decisions on the part of the Justice Department about prosecutions. That is exactly what the White House for months did, was they tried to interfere with the decision of the Justice Department about who should and should not be prosecuted when it came to Bush-era crimes. Scott Horton at Harper's reported that top-level Justice Department officials were furious that Rahm Emanuel and Robert Gibbs were publicly doing this. And Obama finally had to come out and give an interview in which he said, look, this isn't for me to decide. It's for the Justice Department to decide. But everybody knows, the record is very clear, that Holder was continuously pressured by White House officials. And you're absolutely right. Aside from how corrupt the decision itself was not to prosecute these war criminals, the process by which it was done, namely White House interference with the Justice Department, is something that liberals for decades literally have long said is one of the worst things that you can do.
And in fact, we saw, I mean, once this bar is lowered, we saw, and I don't know, you know, I haven't seen enough reporting on the inner workings of this, but, you know, the intense pressure that was applied not just by the DOJ on U.S. state attorneys to sign on to that financial fraud deal, the mortgage fraud deal, but also the advocacy from HUD, which is clearly part of the administration. We're talking about a cabinet member there. Sort of joining in that chorus, it just seems to me that that line of demarcation has been broken down severely, and it because you have that corruption of the process, it presents all sorts of problems going forward in the future for more corruption of that process and coming out of the Department of Justice.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what it does more than anything else is that it makes clear that the White House is devoted, and not just in a theoretical way, but in a passionate, steadfast way, to guaranteeing that the nation's top-level political and financial elites will not be prosecuted for their crimes. And the reason that's so remarkable is that the very first time that President Obama announced that he was running for the president, then Senator Obama, in 2007, in that very first speech where he announced his candidacy, the second or third paragraph, he declared that the, quote, era of Scooter Libby justice would be over. And, of course, the idea of Scooter Libby justice is that if you're sufficiently well-connected politically, that even when you get caught committing crimes, or in the case of Libby, are convicted of committing crimes, you will be protected from punishments that ordinary Americans are routinely subjected to. And it isn't just political elites. It is financial elites as well. Not only has there not been a single Wall Street executive convicted in connection with either the 2008 financial crisis or the mortgage fraud crisis, the Obama administration has continuously applied pressure, as you said, on state attorneys general to hop on board with the settlement that will basically sweep it all under the rug. And the message that is sent is one of lawlessness for elites, and it is one that this administration has been very, very enthusiastic about embracing.
Glenn Greenwald, author of With Liberty and Justice for Some, and, of course, writing daily at Salon.com. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you, Sam. Bye.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break. Boop, boop. And talking about liberty and justice for some, there's a bunch of people who tomorrow are going to take time off from work or from school or from whatever they're doing to go out and protest that there is only liberty and justice for some in our country. And I hope you will join them. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Jeff Smith about some of the actions that are planned for New York, to the extent that he can talk about them. This, I expect this next segment to be our most subpoenaed segment of the week. We'll be right back. Some people say that bowling alleys all look the same. There's not a line that goes here that rhymes with anything. Had a dream last night, but I forget what it was. All right, folks, we are back on the Majority Report, and it's going to be special bonus time for you you freeloaders out there, just because tomorrow is May Day, May 1st. What's the hashtag again on Twitter?
M1GS.
M1GS. And on the phone is from the Occupy Wall Street media team, Jeff Smith. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Oh, well, thanks for joining us. Tomorrow we're going to see you, hopefully, at Bryant Park. I know that people are starting to head out there as early as 9 or 8 a.m. There's going to be guitar me practicing. And Bryant Park is going to be a hub of a bunch of almost sort of micro actions that are going to take place around New York City, as far as I know. Tell me more about what we can expect for May Day tomorrow.
Well, you're right, Sam. What you're going to see is in Bryant Park itself, sort of a staging area for one effort, which is being called 99 Pickets. But basically, it will be a brigade of people who will head out to different businesses and locations around Midtown, and you'll see an actual demonstration just sort of at Pier out of nowhere. And so you can expect many of the same type of corporations that were targeted back in February 29th for the ALEC. So a lot of the big oil companies, big media companies, things like that. But within the actual Bryant Park area, you're also going to see sort of a pop-up occupation that has happened similarly in other parts throughout the city in the weeks leading up. And there you're going to see something that they're calling a mutual aid cluster. So in addition to striking and all the negative actions in terms of trying to disrupt everyone's normal days, we're also looking to do something that's rather positive. So you're going to see music and artwork and teach-ins and what they call a free store. Basically, there will be merchandise there available for free. And in the anti-capitalist spirit, there will be no money being exchanged for any of these things. And really, that's in a lot of ways what this is about. In the same way that Zuccotti Park last fall became sort of a hub for people to gather and expressly do things that were non-commercial, that were non-monetary, and to sort of rediscover the joy that takes place of meeting in public places and sharing in that spirit. And it's really an attempt to galvanize and re-energize a movement, I think, that still has its roots in economic issues that are as important today as they were last fall when this thing started.
And my understanding, there's also going to be a free university down at Madison Square Park. Is that right? Madison Square Park is around 23rd Street, basically right in the middle of the island, 23rd and Broadway or Madison.
That's correct. And that's from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. And then also in the afternoon, there's going to be a large congregation in Union Square as well. So there'll be a free store and similar sorts of teach-ins and things leading up to a rally with Tom Morello and J.D. Samson and Men and Das Racist, and a few musical artists that will headline that. And then from there, the march goes back down to Wall Street at 5:30. And those events are permitted. So there is definitely a distinction between some of the events that are going on that are going to be permitted and not permitted. So the march from Union Square down to Wall Street at 5:30 is a permitted event, as well as the concerts there. So there should be certainly less risk of arrest, I would say, during those events. And then some of the unpermitted events that I think also are notable, at 9 a.m. on tomorrow, there will also be a bike block is going to be having an event at Union Square. So there will be bicycles, and it's always a very interesting sort of experience because a lot of the bikers are really experienced with these sort of protest actions. And so it'll be fun to follow along and see what happens with those guys. And then at 1 p.m., there's also what they're calling a Wildcat March, which, again, in the spirit of the general strike, it's not officially a Wildcat strike or anything like that, but the idea is, again, to assemble people that are members of unions or otherwise that are choosing to participate in this and to express solidarity in that event. And that's going to happen down on East Houston and 2nd Avenue at 1 p.m., so that will also be going on. But really, there's going to be things going on all over the city. There's events in Brooklyn. There's a student walkout in Brooklyn that's happening at midday. And I know there's also a march in Brooklyn that will eventually, via subway, meet up in the afternoon at Union Square. So I would encourage everyone to look to – there's a few places that you want to follow what's going on. One, in terms of media, there's a site called mediaforthe99%.com. And that will be aggregating content from Alternet and Fire Dog Lake, Mother Jones, Truth Out, a lot of the more notable independent and alternative outlets are going to be covering things there, and there will be an interactive map so people can track things going on all over the country. And then, in addition, you can look now at OccupyWallST.org has a full calendar of all the events with links to further info about all the things that are going on around New York City. There are hashtags to follow specifically for New York City. It will be M1NYC, but there are going to be no doubt hashtags assembled for all the different cities. And so if you look either at OccupyTogether.org or on OccupyWallST.org, both of those places I think will be updated throughout the day with individual information. So it's a lot going on, and really I think this is not a means to an end on this day. This is just another attempt to sort of reignite this movement. I see it as, you know, they've been laying kindling in this movement for a long time, certainly along the winter months, and then every once in a while there's time to see if we can really activate union people, immigrant groups, really a wide array of people all into similar themes, and that's really what makes this movement so special and different, I think, in recent history. And, you know, I think back to just a few days ago, there was a big protest day of the ACT UP's 25th anniversary, as yep. well as the 1T Day, the $1 trillion debt for student debt. And so there were actions going on all over the city, and there was a really unique story that happened down right near Zuccotti Park, actually. And it was detailed in an article at WNYC. A producer wrote a reporter's day in the life at Occupy Wall Street. And it was a scenario where construction workers were basically breaking up a non-union site, and they were doing this on their lunch break. And so they were out in the street, and, you know, literally the hipster cop, Rick Lee, shows up at the scene and is like, "What's going on here? Who's the leader?" And they're like, "You know, we're all the leaders, you know." And it very much echoed a lot of the sentiments that Occupy Wall Street has, and the idea that they were, you know, expressing their right on just on a lunch break and really becoming more militant in that sense. I think what we're trying to do overall is get people more comfortable with expressing those same kind of rights. And when you eventually see that tipping point happen, when a lot of groups start really saying, you know, I'm part of this in a way that is more than, you know, following along on TV, then I think it starts to really have power. And so I think we're going to have one more test of that tomorrow. And then looking forward, I think we're going to continue to see it happen.
That really is the point, isn't it? Is at this point when you don't have the central sort of congregating force of an occupation, the idea is to basically instill the spirit of what was going on there in diverse groups across the spectrum of the socioeconomic spectrum, the way that people organize just by without even being conscious of it. I'm a construction worker. I hang out with my construction buddies. I go to this whatever. I hang out in this square on a regular basis. Whatever it is, to get them to sort of embrace almost the ethic, or I guess the credo of empowerment in some respects.
Definitely. I mean, I think it's about extending the idea of what is being involved in politics. Is it more than really just following a campaign and voting? Is it actually participating in a way that's totally outside of the realm of you know, what we're told today is acceptable? And I think that at the more that people start to realize that you can actually affect policy a lot more at times that aren't election times, by being, you know, extremely vocal and out in the streets, and that, you know, hopefully, regardless of what the election outcomes are, that you'll see, you know, the entire frame kind of moved back in a different direction, just purely from this kind of populist voice.
What's happening in other cities? Are you aware specifically of any type of actions? I know that the plans to shut down the Golden Gate Bridge have been scrapped for shutting down the ferries out there, and that there still may be some actions regarding the bridge, but it's going to be a little bit less. It's not officially being done by Occupy now. What else have you heard about around the country?
Well, I know that there are certain cities that continue to be quite active, Seattle, Portland, Los Angeles, San Francisco, definitely are gearing up. Occupy Chicago has also been quite active, I think, leading up to the NATO summit in June has really sort of energized that city. And, I think it remains to be seen what exactly the whole turnout is. But I think that I wouldn't necessarily judge it on its effectiveness to truly, you know, strike or to shut things down. But I think that if it can approach the similar types of numbers that we've had in the past, I mean, you know, it's funny, but we often, Occupy Wall Street often picks a weekday, you know, in kind of the middle of the day to try and pull these things off, obviously for a purpose. And I think it's pretty impressive, the types of numbers that they've been able to turn out. So, you know, I think it would probably take 50,000 people in New York to, you know, exceed the numbers that we've seen in the past. And I think that in some ways on the West Coast, they've almost had more of a jump weather-wise, and that's why you've seen, you know, particularly in San Francisco, them attempt to do things such as, you know, reoccupy a building even earlier in the spring than we've had to do major events. So I think it remains to be seen. I never want to try and predict what's going to happen with these events because I think that's a mistake. But I think it's going to be really big, and I think that the media coverage for this is going to be different than anything that we've seen in the past. I think you're going to see a lot of outlets covered in a way that is more like an actual real news event. At least that's what I'm hoping. And if they choose to ignore it, then I think they're going to miss out on a lot of great stories, because I think you're going to see the alternative media, as usual, kind of gravitate to this thing, and hopefully people will then gravitate that way. I mean,
how do you mean by treating it like it's an actual news event? I mean, what do you think is going to be different? I'm curious about what you mean by that characterization.
Well, I mean, there's obviously the one scenario where there are just, you know, hundreds and hundreds of arrests. And, you know, that, of course, may become the story itself, and I hope it doesn't. But what I mean is just that, you know, generally the corporate press has not really given Occupy Wall Street a fair shake in terms of what they've tried to accomplish, in terms of at least the actual point of the protest. Or the message. And so I'm afraid that if they attempt to ignore this one, that they would look silly. So I think that in some ways it's going to be harder. It really is such a varied type of event, and there are going to be so many things going on. I think it's going to be hard for them to paint it in a similar light as they did Zuccotti Park. It's just sort of people sleeping out. And I don't know. I mean, how do you think it's going to be covered? Or how do you think it's going to unfold media-wise?
You know, I have no sense. The only difference I think that I've noticed is that there is sort of more attempts to do these individual smaller stories, you know, which I think is a good thing, where they actually go in and talk to specific people. That NYC report you talked about is, I think, a good example of that, where they're starting to pick up on the nature of it rather than trying to report it as an organization. They're going out and finding sort of smaller stories, which I think is, you know, a step in the right direction, where it's, you know, here's a small group of people. I don't know. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what kind of resources they dedicate towards it, and if they're able to get their stories, because I know the police, you know, and it's hard again to know, but the police have been training. And it seems to me they've been training for a big action. You know, how do we deal with 20,000 people in one location? And it seems to me that the idea that there could be 500 people in 30 locations is a little more complicated for them. And I'm not sure how they address something like that.
Well, I mean, in some ways, I guess I would call that a win, because
right.
You know, that's always been the goal of Occupy Wall Street, is to focus on, you know, not the sensational story of it, but the actual components and the individual stories. And so if this is a way to kind of do that and de-emphasize some of the salacious parts, I think that's great. I think it's also, in some ways, it doesn't even matter, because this really is an opportunity for mass outreach and to actually, in each one of the cities where things are happening, to actually talk to people and realize that this thing's probably not going to change the world, you know, in a week or a month, and that it may have to be a really years-long process that ultimately, you know, morphs into something that's completely different. But as for right now, in these, you know, early stages, it's still all about outreach. And
right.
I think the in-person elements, getting people out into the streets and talking and engaging, is easily the most powerful aspect of this movement. And so I think that's going to be on full display.
And lastly, you know, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but what happens? Is there any talk of what happens next after this?
Well, there are actually actions all through the week coming up after May Day. So it's not even that this is an end point at all. I think this has been something that's been good as a sort of goalpost over the winter to have to lead up to, and it's always good to prepare for these bigger events. But as far as I know, there's actually individual actions on the 4th and, or on the 3rd and 4th and 5th of this week coming up. So I believe if you go to the OccupyWallaceD.org site, there are some details about that. But I see this as definitely the long haul. I don't think that there's any reason to look at this as, you know, a reason to pack it up or to go. It's not a decision point. And I think that as the summer comes, I mean, summer is really the season, and as electoral politics heat up and the conventions and all sorts of things start going on, I think you're going to see a really hot summer.
Jeff, we'll see you out there tomorrow.
All right. Thanks, Sam.
Okay. We'll talk to you later. Jeff Smith, folks. And that marks the end of our first half of our program. As we head into the better half, James from New Jersey writes, I've been listening to your show for about a year and have quickly come to the conclusion that Majority Report is a rare, relevant, and vitally important source of news and information regarding American politics. Pains me that news you present is hardly represented in any other form of media. Times are tough, money is tight, but I pay for cable TV, and after flipping past CNN, Fox News, and even the grossly unbalanced Meet the Press on NBC, your show on Social Security finally pushed me over the edge where my guilt didn't. I just became a proud member to ease your burden on reporting and discussing real issues. I'm trying to give you the... Thank you, James. And Tom K., Majority Reporter from member day one, says, supporting progressive media is effective. At its best, progressive media not only educates, it also entertains. Well, that's why I had that 360 to do those fanfare songs. It not only empowers us with knowledge, it also inspires us to take action with this knowledge, brings us together, and makes us louder than the sum of our voices. Folks, if you have the means to become a member supporter of this program, please do. It is only your support that keeps this show alive. And the more members we get, the better the show becomes. Means that we have the ability to focus on more things, get better guests, prepare for them better, more stories. It goes on and on, and reach more people, frankly. Later this week, we'll be talking to Senator Russ Feingold. We'll be talking to Eric Alterman. Tomorrow, we'll be out in Bryant Park. I have no idea what's going to happen, but should be interesting. Many other ways to support this program. Go to majority.fm, support the show to find out. See you in the better half. You can call us at 646-257-3920 or IM us at majority.fm. See you then.